We're joined now, I believe, by Montreal publisher Robin Philpott. Are you there?
Yes, hi, Phil.
How you doing? This is an exciting time in the publishing business. You have a couple of books I want to ask you about. Let's begin with Mick Lowe, very prominent journalist in modern times, used to write for the Globe and Mail, the Labor Beat, and he, of course, was a longtime columnist in Sudbury, has a new book published by Baraka called The Raids, the Nickel Range Trilogy. And this is volume one, very striking cover. And the author, again, is Mick Lowe, and the publisher is Baraka Books, and it's just out. Can you tell us about this book and why you think you wanted the readers to hear about this?
Just a little correction. It is available online, but it won't be in bookstores for another month about. So just I don't want people to run out and buy it and then get
online. It's available.
Yeah, you can buy it on our website in advance, but you know, there's always this slow, you know, business until it gets in bookstores. But anyway, when it's available, and if people want to buy it online, they can, and they can get e-books as well. I think it is a great Canadian story, and I'm really proud to publish it. Mm-hmm. Mick Lowe, as you mentioned, he knows the issue. He's been living in Sudbury since 1974.
Oh, he's got nickel dust in him for sure.
Yeah, and he said to himself, and he admitted that it wasn't being humble. He said he wants to do for nickel what Zola did for coal, and he said, I know it's not, but he says, it's a story that. I mean, just initial reactions from, for instance, Dave Patterson, who was a former leader of the
Leader of Steelworkers.
The Steelworkers in Sudbury, in that period after he started working, when this book takes place in the mid-60s, when early 60s, 63, 64, a young guy goes to work there. It is a novel. It's an exciting story. It's a love story, but it also shows riots and fighting over principles, and the participation of the CIA, and Nick posits that what was being carried out there was a fight to the finish against real serious militant trade unionism. Mm-hmm. And the steelworkers at the time were working, the CIA was infiltrating the steelworkers in order to beat back this.
Yeah, they had a war. McCarthyism, it's called, in North America, but people forget it. That wasn't Joe McCarthy. It was there was what they called a Red Scare. Yeah. And there was a Canadian Seamen's Union, a terrific union, by the way. And there were longshoremen. And and depending upon the politics of their leaders, the state decided to bust them up.
And so Mick has imagined a story, but it's so real that you learn about it. I think people and from anybody who lives in Northern Ontario, anybody who's been in the union movement, or basically any Canadian or even American for that matter, is going to find this story so enlightening and also exciting to read. I mean, he decided to use fiction, and I think it's probably the best bet because he's telling about something that nobody has really wanted to know about. There must be taboos. I'm originally from Northern Ontario. I know some of this, but nothing like what Mick has described in Sudbury, where they had this biggest mine mill local in North America, operating in a mm-hmm. whole group of mines there in the 60s, and it was to defeat this mine that these events were going on. And, of course, also Mick tells the story of mining, and anybody who's mined or been around miners is going to just find it so realistic. The guy understands it, and he's got such a vocabulary and such a rich way of telling a story. Anyway, it's a wonderful book, and in addition, we have six or seven original illustrations putting you into the atmosphere of the 60s in Sudbury by Orest Sawchuk, who is a a guy who's, I guess he's like Mick. He's very concerned about the you know, that area's labor history. Anyway, it's
Sudbury is a world, and that those the ghosts of that struggle are still around, and people talk, and it's reached the point of kind of a legend. You can't be in Sudbury without it quietly being raised in conversation. Issues between language, by the way, came up in that battle.
Absolutely.
Issues between churches came up. And there was a lot of skullduggery, and it's very interesting that this has been not been able until now. There's been no novel about this, and here it was one of the great labor struggles in Canadian history.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's a labor struggle, but you have a world. The background is the whole world. I mean, you have a bunch of people who are former Nazi collaborators who own buildings. I mean, I don't want to tell this, but the story is so enlightening and exciting, you know. Mm-hmm. And sometimes historical novels are hard to read through. Everybody who I've given it to, who's read it so far, and you know, I've asked mm-hmm. comments and stuff, they're just thrilled.
I've talked to miners about it, and they say that's the book begins with a young miner going into his first days of work, and they said that's how it was.
Yeah.
And by the way, a great tribute to Mick, because he's a journalist. Mick is not a miner, but he's got a good ear, and he's a Sudbury guy. He's got Sudbury in his bones, and so he's been listening. And my guess is that if he could just take notes in his sleep, he'd have the whole thing, which is probably how he did it.
He's also got a very interesting journalist character in there, and very interesting, and
skinny, red hair.
Sorry,
I said, is he skinny with red hair?
No. But he's caricature a bit. Yeah. But no, personal.
By the way, there were some great reporters there, and some of them he knew.
He,
I know that Mick used to interview the old reporters who told him stories.
Yeah, and the old reporters who had sometimes left their writing business and became working with Mine Mill, and so it's something that. Mm-hmm. Anybody, you know, and I think that we're lucky that somebody told this story and told it the way it was, and with people from Sudbury, you know, areas that everybody sort of lift their nose at or look down upon.
We have to read it because what's the saying? The past is prologue, right?
Right. And the other thing is that Mick's working on the second, and so I just can't wait to see what's going to happen in the second.
Find out what happens next.
Anyway, so it's called The Raid.
The Raid, Mick Lowe, Baraka Mick Books. Lowe. We're speaking to Robin Philpott, publisher at Baraka Books. And, of course, it's available online. In about 1 month's time, it'll be in the stores. And
hopefully we'll have...
And I look forward to interviewing Mick at that time, actually.
Oh, yeah.
We've had him on, you know, because he's written a couple of other books... one about the development of mines and down east, and he also talked about, of course, told this great motorcycle gang story, the death and the investigations and the terrible things that went on in that. So he's got a string of successful books, and this is, I think, his first time he's ventured into novel writing.
It is, and I think, I think it's a very happy adventure for him. I just by the reaction of different readers, some readers, by the way, who know nothing about mines and mm-hmm. who know nothing about Sudbury, and they can't put it down. So
by the way, there's a great, if you want to supplement this, there's a film called Salt of the Earth made about the same struggle and set in the American Southwest, same unions and the same battle.
Wonderful film, I agree.
Now, we can't. Now we're speaking to Robin Philpott, who is himself the author of a book which is getting wide attention around the world. It's titled "Rwanda and the New Scramble for Africa: From Tragedy to Useful Imperial Fiction." And now, Robin, this is how we describe this. I see it's described as an enriched. Is this a? new and enlarged? Well, what's the terminology that's used?
It's an updated book. Originally, I wrote a book in French called Ça ne s'est pas passé comme ça à Kigali, which was published in 2003. mm-hmm. A book that then was published in France, and then was published in German, thanks to your website, mm-hmm. because I translated at that time, but we had
people asking us, please, to put it somewhere so that they could read it.
And so they could, and because we said, well, this is interesting, and in fact, it led to interesting work. Ed Herman read it then, and he and David Peterson produced that wonderful book of The Politics of Genocide, which in many cases was based on some of the research that I did and others had done. And but the problem is that no publisher had wanted to take it. And now that we have this Varica Books, we founded it about 5 years ago, mm-hmm. and we decided that we should put this out but update it. For the 20th anniversary of the shooting down of the plane.
Yeah, the anniversary is coming up, and at this very moment, once again, all the aspects of this are being revisited with new material and new personalities coming into this. When you, of course, wrote this originally, there was no Teogen Rudasingwa, as a matter of fact, when you wrote your book, Mr. Rudasingwa was still intimate with and a close associate of the present leader of Rwanda, Paul Kagame. He has since left that post and lives abroad and has himself written a book, which basically confirms everything that you have in your book.
Yeah, I read his book with great interest because here's a man who believed in what they were doing. From the beginning, up until around 2000, I think then he was already losing interest. And as was the case with Patrick Karegeya.
The man who was strangled in South Africa.
Yeah. And his book, the interesting thing about Teogen Rudasingwa's book is that things that I had written and then are reconfirmed in this book, in fact, enriched. When I say enriched, I've kept the basic same story, but I've added a lot of information, references, and certain new things to it. And when I read Rudasingwa's book, I felt happy that, in fact, what I was saying was what he was saying. Mm-hmm. And for instance, one of the things that I realized in his book was, and I had advanced this, that and this basically came from Boutros Ghali's interview where he said it was the Rwandan
interview with you.
He said it to me, but 100% U.S. responsibility. He had said the Americans and the British did everything they could to stop any form of UN intervention, to stop the fighting and to protect and to make sure there would be no, and to stop the killing, stop mm-hmm. the fighting and stop the killing that was going on. And the British and the Americans had stopped it. Well, then Rudasingwa said it in his book. He said, our strategy was to make sure there would be no international force. This is in April and May. We sent people to Washington and New York, and that's where it was communicated. But our public strategy was to say that the international community sat idly by and didn't do anything and abandoned the Tutsi. In other words, he comes out and says exactly the same thing mm-hmm. as I do. So, and he was at that time with Kagame because he believed in it. And I think after he said, yes, we made mistakes. So.
As was Patrick Karegeya.
Right.
We were speaking to Robin Philpott, and the book is Rwanda and a New Scramble for Africa. That's Baraka Books, available, by the way, at a different book list here in Toronto and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. One thing, it has been said, English language publishing houses, there's been unanimity on this subject, and therefore it must mean that the story received through the English language publishers was so. And no one paid any attention, of course, to the fact that in the French language, many participants, direct participants in the events mm-hmm. who had different conclusions were writing. And mm-hmm. it brings up something I wonder if you could elaborate on. Noam Chomsky recently called American politics. He said, we live in an Anglo sphere.
Right.
And really, we only consider something if it's in English.
Exactly. And there has been a lot of material. There has been a lot of material in France, in French.
Yeah, and in Belgium. I think of someone like Luc Marchal, who was a very important figure. He was on the scene for all these great moments, the famous fax moment, and the interview with the Turret Sinzi, the informant.
Yeah.
Luc Marchal was there.
Yeah, and nobody ever interviews him. He's been interviewed here in Quebec in French, but because it's in French, it doesn't exist for the Anglosphere, as Chomsky said. And another great investigative journalist is Pierre Payan, who just wrote an article in the current issue of Marianne where he interviewed another close collaborator of Kagame. And he describes how they planned to assassinate President Habyarimana, how they put
Let me just remind our listeners about that. Because this is what the anniversary is. On April the 6th, 1994, the country was at peace, and they were in a process called the Arusha Accords, which is going to give them a new parliament and a multi-party system, and they were sharing power, and there was going to be an election. But on April the 6th, 1994, President Habyarimana and President Ntaryamira of Burundi were assassinated, and there was a struggle for power waged by the RPF, and they were victorious, and all those things in the Arusha Accord never happened.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, in the French language, here, for instance, today in Le Devoir, one of their international commentator wrote an excellent article about the shooting down of the plane in the 20 years. He said, you know, revisionism is bad, but it's time we were revisionist about what happened in Rwanda. It's time that we did a bit of revising our beliefs.
Well, unless we are members of churches, you have no choice but to revisit and bring scholarship to any subject. I mean, I don't know. It seems to me there's an attempt to intimidate and say, no one is to go there. Nobody's to ask any questions. And you say, you mean if a witness walks forward and tells us something, we're not to listen?
Yeah. Well, what they have is a way. What they do is they shut up that kind of witness by saying you're a negationist or you're a denier. Or,
well, by the way, speaking of shutting up revisionists, Patrick Karegeya, who was a major figure in the Rwandan Patriotic Front, the former head of intelligence, external intelligence there, wrote his last long letter included the comment that this guy, Paul Kagame, will stop at nothing. He will assassinate presidents.
Yeah.
A clear allusion to the assassination of Habyarimana.
Right.
And the same is true of General Yamwasa.
Mm-hmm.
And so our listeners got to remember, Karegeya was murdered. This is contemporary. Now we have a dust up between South Africa and Rwanda over this kind of conduct. Attempted assassination and a successful assassination carried out on South African soil by agents of the Rwandan government.
Right, exactly. So getting information in English is a complicated, and it, of course, Rwanda is a problem. Because it's a French language, unfortunately, we can. But I think that it's a phenomenon in other areas as well. I know you've been talking about Ukraine and elsewhere. It would be so good if you could read what's being written in Russian. This is a problem of the Anglosphere because there is a mentality that we only need this language.
Well, what we all notice, I think, is that it's sort of we're inclined to have a sort of a servant mentality where we're told, "Don't read that,"
right?
And you say, "Why not?" Because I said, "What else? What other explanation is it?" The Soviet Union is gone, so why am I supposed to become a Russophobe?
Yeah,
I thought that the poor Russians were under that terrible system, et cetera, and therefore. And that's why we were supposed to be unhappy with them. Turns out we just don't like Russians.
Yeah.
It's all it is Russophobia.
Yeah.
for some, by the way, reasons that they're not shared with us by, you know, in the capitals of Ottawa and Washington and Paris.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons we founded Barrica Books, because we do want to produce books that otherwise would not see the day, light of day, in English, in the Anglosphere. Mm-hmm. So it's a phenomenon which it touches the case of Rwanda. It touches it touches Quebec.
Well, you must be heartened, by the way, that now your book is being widely circulated. I'm seeing commentary on it and reviews, primarily positive reviews, in a number of highly respected publications. And it's been heartening, and also some solid journalists have begun to take up this issue. For many years, they sort of, you know, it got lost in time.
Yeah, I think there's an element of intimidation as well, that people have been scared to deal with this because of the bitter way. I mean, you get compared to being a Holocaust denial or that kind of thing. But I think we're overcoming it because finally, perhaps, you know, we'll see. But
I think everybody will choose their favorite weapon. You know, like if you have some mud, make sure you throw it.
Right, exactly.
It should be underlined that you actually broke new ground here. You spoke to a number of individuals who were there, prepared to answer questions if someone would come and ask them. And exactly. if there was anybody qualified to talk about the events in 1994 and needed to be heard from, it was Boutros-Ghali.
And I would say that, and on Boutros-Ghali, he wasn't hard to reach. I interviewed him twice, and he answered positively to my letters immediately. I don't think he's been interviewed in English, and his statement.
Madeleine Albright said she did not like that man.
She called him Frenchie.
And nobody's therefore don't talk to him.
Yeah, and so people didn't, and I don't think that, even though this fact that he has said this. It's been repeated. It's been said in English, and people know. Why have not some of these major media decided in English to go and see him? He's been interviewed by Le Monde in France and about it, and he's said repeated this kind of thing. But it's you know, I think Chomsky hit on a point with the Anglosphere.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah. Yes, and certainly within the Francophone world, they have to deal with this because there are a number of good journalists and people who've been commenting, and so it's part of their vocabulary. And also they know of whom they're speaking. But in the Anglosphere, it's quite a narrow world, and there's only three or four people permitted to say anything.
Right.
And that's been the story, although it's changing now. And by the way, thanks very much to the courage of people like Teogen Rudasingwa.
Right.
And also of Patrick Karagea, and others who simply come forward just because they want the world to know that this is not a democracy that was established there.
My feeling is that, and from what I've talked to a few of them, and is that they really do want to solve the problem. They do want to heal the nation, as they call it.
Well, as a matter of fact, we all have heard Tutsi Hutu, but these individuals have reached out. I notice that if you look at them, it is probably 50-50 in terms of Hutu Tutsi participation in this group that is now calling out Kagame for running a dictatorship and for using brutal methods on his critics. We've been speaking to Robin Philpott. Unfortunately, they're coming to the end of the hour. So, Robin, we want to thank you very much. It's Rwanda and the New Scramble for Africa, Baraka Books. We look forward to talking to you further about all these matters.
Okay, thanks, Phil. Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye. Robin Philpott.